Live from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, it's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
Welcome to the Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show. My name is Alon.
My name's Ara.
And behind the glass over there is Andrew, calling our wonderful guest we're going to have on today. Later in the show, I think segment two will bring on Vladimir Kohl of Joystick.com. You guys hear me talk about Joystick probably once, twice, three times a show. I look at their site a lot, and he wrote a very interesting article, in my opinion, regarding Xbox Live and quarter munching as it applies to old retro games. So I want to talk to him about that for a couple segments. I think he's on the line now waiting to come on for next segment. If you guys want to talk to Vlad or talk about us, about whatever you'd like, give us a call at 866-536-1100 anytime during the show, and maybe we'll bring you on the air. Now, Ara, there's a couple things I want to talk about, aside from talking to Vlad about the Xbox Live Arcade quarter-munching article, which I'll describe in more detail later.
Yeah.
The PS3 market, gray market, which is something that actually Kotaku brought up this week after our last show. I had wanted to talk about it last Monday, but we ran out of time because, you know, you see all these people creating, well, there was all this demand for the system early on, which we all expected, right? And all the market on eBay for markup and getting lots of cash after waiting for 36 hours outside of a Walmart or a Best Buy or something. And that seems to have fizzled. And I'm sort of curious about what may be the reality, what's actually happening here, because apparently it's very easy to get a system these days. So I want to talk about that. Also, each of us have had some experience on Xbox Live recently playing Texas Hold'em.
Yeah.
I guess.
That's a lot of fun.
Did you have to actually join Xbox Live simply so you could play Texas Hold'em?
Yeah, I was pretty miffed about that.
Why was that not in your general expectation?
It wasn't, because poker doesn't make any sense unless you're playing with people. So
they've got a single player element in that game.
Yeah, they do. But you know, I didn't want to play with those computer players. It's not the same thing, you know.
No, it's pretty easy to beat them actually.
Yeah.
But so you just thought that for that one game they wouldn't require that you get Xbox Live to play online?
Well, you know, I mean, I wasn't entirely surprised, but you know, being the cheap guy that I am and not wanting to pay more, I was just like, hey, you know, this is a I'm already coughing up the dough for this download. The other thing I'm miffed about is that I had 200 points, right? And this game was like 800 points.
Yeah, but you can't buy 600.
And I just can't buy, like, why can't I just buy enough to buy the game? No, you have to buy 1,000 points, you know? So now I've got all these other extra points laying around that, you know, they're probably hoping I'm going to buy, like, some like, icons with or something like that.
Maybe you could buy the Halo 3 first...
Yeah,
first trailer theme.
Or that. It's kind of annoying, you know, because, it's so transparent that they're just setting this up in the structure so that you end up always just paying a little more money than you need to buy stuff.
Yeah, so, well, it's kind of like getting gift cards, but you generally get them in, like, you know, even increments, right?
Right, but then you can spend the gift card and then pay cash.
Yeah.
And then and you can't do this.
That's a good point.
So,
all right, so while I was playing... because I do play a lot of the Hold'em online. One time, this was Sunday. I was playing on one of the higher up tournaments where people are a lot more serious about the game because it costs more money to get in. You've been playing just the free roll stuff, which is where you get a bunch of morons.
That's
who just
right.
Go all in all the time.
And then I have a few things to say about those morons, but
yeah,
continue.
I mean, we're all aware of the Xbox Live experience, how you frequently find out about morons. So,
indeed.
Yeah. Anyway. When you play in Texas Hold'em, there's all these tiers. You can play the free tournament where everybody just is stupid and goes all in every 3 seconds. And I'm trying not to get too detailed about poker because
right.
It's not really my point, but
right.
People are doing stupid things, right? And then the higher up they get more serious, because in the case of Texas Hold'em, where you have this persistent bankroll, people, even though the money is completely meaningless, right, they want to know that it persists, whatever. They're concerned about it.
Right. Well, so, ideally, you should be treating it almost as if it was like money.
Yeah.
That's how you play the game.
And that's the good thing, because they do. And I think most people use it as practice for real-world play. And so that's what I find interesting about it. In fact, there was one guy who was playing online for money while playing Xbox Live with us.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, so you have to wait like half an hour when you're playing the $50,000 tournaments just to get it to start because there aren't that many people playing. And you're playing with people all over the world, right? Because there's just not that many. Wow. I'd like to think that there were more. And in fact, I'm very surprised it was hard to get an 8-person game together. But for whatever reason, it was. And so we're sitting there and the guy's asking like, all right, so you're the host of this game, Mr. Whoever, you know, have you ever dropped people? And he's going off this checklist, like, because he wants to make sure the game doesn't get dropped and he loses his money, which is a legitimate concern. But I was surprised, first of all, that you could tell who the host was. And now I know how, at least before the game starts, you can. But like they were taking it really seriously and I was happy to see that. But then this guy who's asking all these questions and being real chatty the whole time, while we're talking, he's like, oh, you know, it got quiet. You guys aren't talking anymore. I said, well, you want to talk about something other than poker, so don't give away my hand? And he starts telling me all about Viva Pinata. This guy's like 40 years old, right? And I guess he bought Viva Pinata for his little
girl.
This
is all over the poker game online.
Yeah, while playing poker, telling me all about Viva Pinata, more than I ever wanted to know about Viva Pinata. And he's really into it, and he has some super rare pinata. He's telling me to go to certain websites where they, you know, like pinataisland.something.
And yeah. This is another game I don't understand, although I haven't played it yet, but I saw that fake demo they had online, the video.
The trailer.
It's like the marginally interactive trailer or whatever. And I don't know. I don't get it. Yeah.
Well,
I don't understand.
The thing is, like, it was just fascinating to me to see this guy, you know, obviously a father, and into a game like I'm into, like poker, and then just completely, like, he was head over heels for this pinata game. And apparently, like, honestly, Viva Pinata, supposed to be a good game. Everybody says it's good, although, you know, not necessarily for every group of person or every type of person. But
kind of like how they say the Rayman Rapids, whatever, is good.
I don't want to talk about Rayman Rapids.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was just really interesting for me to hear like this 40, 43 or however old the guy is telling me like in great detail and personal interest about Viva Pinata. Anyway, that's my little story about Hold'em and why Xbox Live is moronic most of the time. And other times you talk about Viva Pinata.
You know, one thing about Xbox Live that I think is kind of also moronic is, you know, now this is part of their standards. When you make a game playable online, and you know, I know this because, you know, some of the games I've worked on in the past, they kind of make you create all these categories of games, right?
Yeah.
When you play online, you have to have the ranked match, and you have to have the non-ranked match, and you have to have the quick match, and you have to have the custom match.
Yeah, they've got their checklist
if right.
You want to go live.
Right. And I'm not really sure how they're trying to impose this structure. In other words, I'm not really sure exactly to what degree they're making people literally have those four options, but you know, most developers are doing that. They're basically having like those four options, right? There's two options usually in one menu, and then the next one you get two more options. And I don't know, to me it's just completely wasteful design-wise.
Are you just talking about interface design?
Yeah, just, I mean, as far as like the interface goes, to make the player make those kinds of choices with them, which makes no sense, you can very, very easily kind of like integrate that type of decision-making kind of like intrinsically within, which I'm not going to get into the details of now unless I don't know, somebody really
cares.
Yeah,
we only have a couple minutes.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, it's just, you know, because the terminology is so confusing, like custom match, quick match, you know? Well, I mean, like, what does that even mean?
If you're using the poker game as an example, let me point out that poker is completely idiotic, the way they set up. Like, you can go into custom match where supposedly you have control
right,
over options.
Right, and I
yet
did
there
want to
literally
use it as
zero
an example,
options.
But yeah. This is kind of like, it's kind of like endemic of almost every online game that I've played. They present the online options in just such an incongruent way.
Yeah, don't use poker as an example, because the Texas Hold'em example is factually broken in terms of their option system and their interface. They updated it, so it's not as broken as it used to be, but it's still, like, you go to a custom match, and it specifically says, go and set options, basically, you know, not
right.
In those words. And then you go, and there are literally zero options you can choose,
right.
Aside from, do you want to play the $0, the $4,000, the $50, whatever.
Well, that's even worse.
But all those other options, you can't set, unless you're in the non-competitive match. Anyway, I'm moving past that. We have a caller. Do we have, like, a minute, Andrew? 2 minutes. All right, let's take Mark from Ontario. Mark, you're on the air with Chatterbox.
Hi, Alan. It's a pleasure to be talking to you guys.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, what's up?
I can barely hear you, though. Hang on 1 second here.
Okay.
All right. I'm better now.
Well,
right,
that's
can you hear me
better.
Okay right now?
Okay,
yes.
That's
now the screen,
almost too good, in fact.
On the screen, it tells me you want to talk about an Xbox Live scam.
Yeah, well, I thought that's something you'd be really interested in. There's these unlocking... Somebody recently found out these downloadable contents. One's even for Viva Pinata.
Mm-hmm.
And they discovered there's these different, like, you know, map packs or different clothes for your gangster and Godfather or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out that these different downloads all cost 108 kilobytes each. And this is something I read on TMXbox.com. So he looked at it. This guy posted this thing on there on the forum. And he said, like, so they all cost 108 kilobytes each, so that's way too small to be a map or something. So the theory that's going around is that you're paying some additional money for content that's already on the disk.
Right. Well, how is that a scam?
Yeah, you're simply unlocking it.
Yeah, well, it's not stuff that you can already unlock. Like, there's, like, some stuff you guys have talked about before, like with the EA, how it's cars you could already play to unlock.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But this is stuff, like, the only way to get to it is to pay extra money for it. There's no other way to get to it.
Right. But how is that a scam, though?
It's the same system. The method of content delivery really is irrelevant. I mean, if you're getting it, that they're just trying to bilk money out of you,
this
like,
is interesting,
I'm with you.
Though. I want to hear Mark's response, though.
Yeah. We'll come back to you, man. Stay through the break, and we'll hear a little, and then we'll get to Vlad. We've got Vlad on the phone from joystick.com. That's JOYSTIQ. And Mark will talk to you for 1 second after the break, and then get in with Vlad. Stay tuned, everybody.
Welcome back to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name is Ara.
And I'm Alon.
And we've got Andrew back there manning all the funny sounds and the phones and all that good stuff.
So, before we move on, I got to remind everybody that UAT, the University of Advancing Technology, is one of our wonderful sponsors. And if you want to visit their website, uat.edu, you too can learn how to join their school and, learn how to make games. Now, we were talking about Xbox Live right before we got to the break. And I want to bring Mark back on. Hear his response here, because you and I, it sounds like we understand that the content delivery really is irrelevant.
Right, but I'm curious to hear what Mark has to say.
So, Mark, you're back.
Okay, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
All right. Well, I understand what you're saying about content delivery, but I'm just thinking it seems like a bit of a rip-off. If you bought a game and there's more content on the game that's already there, the game you purchased, and the only way to get to that is by paying more money. It's like saying, you know, if you wanted a new map for Call of Duty 3, but it's already on the disc that you bought, but you have to download, like, a key to unlock it.
Yeah,
like, there's no way to get to it by playing it yourself, you know? I could understand if it's additional content they're providing after the game's release that you download, say you downloaded an actual map. But this is just downloading a key to unlock it on a disc that you already paid
for. What's the real difference here? I mean, because yes, indeed, what they've done is they've, you know, just as you said, they've taken a part of the game, and they're just deciding, okay, well, this is going to be actually like post-game content, and we're going to charge extra for it. But whether they're giving that to you via a download, or whether it's just on there and you're just downloading the key to unlock it, I mean, why does it matter, really?
Let me jump in for a second. I think he's sort of taking the stance that I've said in the past, things like things that should normally be part of a game now are not, and we're having to pay extra for it.
Yeah,
and that bothers me.
That's exactly what I'm saying. If you already paid for it, and they could just as easily have it in there.
I guess it depends on, you know, exactly what content we're talking about, it depends on what example we've got here.
Right.
The truth is, though, once you become accepting of the fact that you will be paying for extra content, regardless of what that content is, then the point you're trying to make is no longer valid. Because now that this model exists, they will hire additional, you know, people on the team, hire, you know, whatever they need to do, or pay the extra money involved in production to make this content. And so the fact that they do it ahead of time, knowing that they will then charge, isn't really important anymore. Back in the past, when there wasn't that delivery system, then I can understand. They make the game, and if they're going to make more content, it's coming on a new disc where you're paying more money. But in this case, now they understand. It sucks.
Right.
I wish they would just give it to me.
Depends on the context, though. Is there a particular game you're talking about, Mark?
Oh, there's a list of them on here. One for Viva Pinata. There's a few accessory packs. Rally. Well, what else we got on here? I'm just checking this list I got online. Alaskan. None of them, like, they all look like really crappy games, actually.
Yeah. I mean,
none of them are actually any big game titles. Like, if it's just you're paying for an extra, like, you know, jersey in a sports game, that's probably not as severe. But I could see people getting carried away and charging you for maps or something that's more expensive. You know what I'm saying?
No, and, like, Ara and I, the cheapskate in us, at least, well, I guess I can only speak for myself. Like, I can understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
little, you know, itty bitty things, like, you know, you know, a new coat for your guy in the game, like, that doesn't really matter. But, you know, I can get into, say, like, what would happen with Luminase if you got to pay for the rest of the game.
Yeah,
like,
but, I mean, we...
Well, I don't think that'll happen, though.
We, as the consumer, as I'm sure you've heard before, have the ability to boycott this sort of system by not paying for it. And that may change the model in the future. So there's all this experimentation that's happening with the new delivery systems that exist today. And so, you know...
They're trying to see how much they can rip you off by, basically.
Exactly. People are testing us. And if you're willing to plunk down the credit card for Microsoft points and or give away Microsoft points that you apparently have in excess, as is Ara's situation...
That's right.
Then, you know, they'll keep doing it. And so I just say, don't feed the birds or whatever, because they'll keep coming back. Anyway, thank you, Mark, for calling, and we appreciate the call. Now it's time to go to Vlad. I think we're a little bit late on this anyway, but we've got plenty of show in front of us. Vladimir Cole from joystick.com. Andrew, can we bring him on?
Hello.
Hey there, Vlad. It's Alon.
And how's it going?
Hey, wonderful. What's up, Vlad?
I'm doing well here in Philly.
Right on.
So Vlad, before we start up in the real discussion here, tell me a little bit about your relation to Joystick. How long have you been there?
I've been writing for Joystick since... January 2005, so with just 2-year anniversary, I guess, coming up soon. Anyway,
congratulations for that.
So initially I was one of the bloggers and moved up to managing editor, and recently have scaled back my responsibilities just because school's kicking my butt, but still writing.
I'd read some stuff about that, and see, one thing I don't know if Ara reads the site as much as I do, but you can sort of tell that certain bloggers fall into certain categories, and you tend to have the more intellectual, introspective articles than some of the other folks. Simply, that seems like your style.
Yeah, I mean, I try to... Joystick has always been, or tried to take an editorial stance that we're not the mainstream, or we want to take angles that other people aren't taking. And so I particularly endorse that editorial strategy, and I like to do stuff that others aren't doing, and sometimes that gets me in the hot water, which is, I think, what kind of prompted this call.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say that it's putting yourself in that position or writing that sort of material, I think, tends to have more emotional response, right? Because there's more content for people to actually react to.
And so, I have to just interject that I definitely really, really enjoy more editorializing in the press in general, because I'm just... so sick of, you know, oh, this game is good and here are 5 adjectives about how good it is, and or this game is bad and here's 5 adjectives that describe how bad it is. It just gets boring to me.
Well, and that's what they're doing with Joystick, providing some other types of content as well. And so this article that I'm referring to specifically, and I've intentionally like avoided talking to you, Vlad, at least so our listeners understand, about this ahead of time, right? Because I never, and even with Ara, like, I don't like to tell him what I'm going to talk about on the show, because then
he's a little tricksy like that.
Yeah, it will change the content of the show. Well, I've done it before, and we end up having really bland conversations on the air. So, anyway, this article is entitled, well, minus the update part, Quarter Gobblers Are Broken on Xbox Live Arcade. And so, for the listeners, this is basically Vlad saying, and certainly correct me if I'm wrong, that back in the day, when you were playing arcade games, you'd have to pop in a quarter every time you died. And this was the case for pretty much every game that existed 20 years ago. You know, Space Invaders and Gauntlet is the example in this article.
If you wanted to continue.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, you play once, and then if you die, okay. And when there's a storyline or successive levels or something, like, it's less important in Space Invaders, where you're just trying to get as far as you can and get score, but it's the same sort of idea. Where in Gauntlet, you've got all these levels, and you want to get to the end and see some potential ending or congratulations screen or whatever. So that's why Gauntlet is a great example here. And they're saying... or Vlad at least is saying, you know, the mechanic of paying money and having sort of risk involved increases the tension and increases interest in the game, because there's something that's counting against you, right? And when you have this invincibility mode of being able to just pop in a new quarter every second when you die, it really detracts from the experience. Am I right? That's what you're getting at?
Yep, and I'd add, and I didn't really put this in the article, and I think now in retrospect that I should have, what the important thing is that it makes skill matter. So once you improve your game, you start to last longer and longer on a single quarter. And so you start to feel a real joy in stretching your quarter for the maximum experience. And I did mention this in the article. I mean, one of my best memories of gaming ever was sitting on an arcade cabinet for Street Fighter II.
I was going to say the Street Fighter II syndrome.
Yeah, for a couple hours without being defeated. I mean, that's just a really nice feeling. And just the fact that when you do get defeated, you've got to pull another quarter out of your pocket. It just makes it much more emotional and involving.
I agree with you. Now, the music is queuing up here, so we're going to go. We're going to be back in just a minute. We'll continue this. Obviously, we didn't leave much time this segment. We might roll into the fourth segment tonight, too. Stay tuned with us, everybody, and call in 866-536-1100 if you want to talk to us or Wyatt.
KFNX.
It's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's a number one. Woohoo!
And we're back with Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name's Alon. Next to me
is Ara.
And, of course, Andrew's running the show from behind the glass over there. Now, we've got Vladimir Cole from joystick.com. That's joystick.com. And I want to bring him back right away. You there, Vlad?
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent. So you were just talking about this what I call the Street Fighter II syndrome, being able to play for a very long time on a single credit, right?
Right.
And so I guess this is sort of part of the feeling or the impetus for this article about, well, Gauntlet is the example, but old school arcade games and how the quarter munching is gone from Xbox Live Arcade. Now,
one
question I'm curious of, like, is this something you've been thinking about for a long time and only realized that Xbox Live Arcade would make it possible, conceptually anyway?
Actually, I interviewed the head of Microsoft Casual Games Group back in the fall of 2005, and I mentioned that Gauntlet had this problem, and he suggested, like several of Joystick's readers suggested, that, you know, if you really want to play the game that way, you can just hold off and not hit that button that gives you extra life. But, you know, we don't have a lot of self-control, and if it's in the game and you can hit a button to get extra life, you probably will, but I think in doing so, the fun goes away, and I have been thinking about it and puzzling over it for a long time.
That's a really interesting point, actually, because, you know, I was actually going to bring that up, right, that... You know, yeah, you can just exercise your self-control and decide not to continue, right?
Right.
But I think that you're right that, you know, it's even though you have the option of, you know, saying, okay, you know, I'm not going to keep playing. I'm just going to use one credit and die and then play over again. The game, I mean, it's really, I think, a fundamental design flaw when the game is structured in such a way so that, you know, your greatest incentive is to, yeah, just keep on using credits until you get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's been actually a problem with the way arcade games have been designed all the way from the beginning, you know, because in the beginning you had, you know, like, one of the things that I remember the most is, like, you know, those Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles style games, right, with the four
mm-hmm.
players, and, you know, they had, like, that Simpsons game, which is exactly the same format.
And Golden Axe.
And, yeah, and Golden Axe, exactly. Like, all
right.
Those games, right? And you just, you know, nobody...
Popping in the quarters.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Nobody played those with one credit, right? And the game, I mean, I think that, like, when we were all little kids, there was some attraction to, you know, okay, well, I'll put another quarter and see what's next, and I'll put another quarter and see what's next, and you get to see the whole game, and that was kind of rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very kind of sophomoric experience, right? Because you do that a couple times, and then you realize, wow, you know what, this is kind of boring.
Yeah, and you would never go back and play it again if you actually succeeded in completing the game.
Unless you're easily amused.
Well,
but yeah.
I agree that those games are fundamentally flawed in the first place. I mean, Gauntlet, etc., aren't necessarily games at the pinnacle of design. But given that they were designed for a certain environment in a certain context, which was the arcade, I think that only now, because of MS Point, for instance, have we had the opportunity to play the games as they were intended. So I think it was a missed opportunity to do a true port, because Gauntlet's hit every system since, you know, 1985, since its release, and none of those have been true to the mechanic that was present in the arcade.
Right.
That's what I was advocating.
I would question, was that mechanic, which what I think we're talking about is the, you know, plop another quarter in to add 600 or 700 health, was that mechanic really any good?
I think you can judge whether it was any good by how much attention it held. I mean, I think in the day, it was a very successful game. It made the owners of the Gauntlet cabinet a lot of money, arcade owners.
Andrew, oh, it lets you have the trigger finger there.
Andrew's working. Do you want to talk about this, Andrew? Do we?
Andrew.
Oh.
They'll let you have the trigger finger there.
Andrew's working. Do you want to talk about this, Andrew? Do we need? Okay. Well, whatever.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that once you add the unlimited play, which essentially for Gauntlet on Xbox Live Arcade is invincibility mode,
right.
Once you add that, your interest drops suddenly and precipitously. I think it holds even less of a candle than it did back in the arcade days. I think it's undermined to a great degree.
I would agree on that. I think that's true, but I think that I'd also challenge your premise that, you know, there was actually like an appreciable emotional content to, you know, plopping quarters in. I mean, there definitely was on some level, but on the other hand, you know, you can, a lot of times that's completely destroyed. You know, you'll go in even as a kid, right? And if you have $5 to spend, you'll just go in the $5 worth of quarters, and you'll be just throwing those things in like, you know, they're just candy.
Well, if you're dumb, but you also recognize that there's a very finite limit to your quarters. And so you,
right.
You have this concept that, okay, I'm going to go to the arcade. My mom gave me $5. You know, can I beat the game in 20 tries? Will
right.
I be able to do it? And I'll try next time even harder, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different from absolutely unlimited play. But I think that, like, on the level of a quarter, at least in my experience, you know, it's really, like, it's not that big of a cost to the player.
I mean, I think when in the example when all you had was $5 of your allowance, I think it was a very meaningful experience to plunk all $5 into the machine. Next week you came back and you said, I'm going to get a lot farther than I did last week. And you really focused and you hit those buttons until your arms were sore. I think it was... I definitely remember being in the arcade and caring very much about how well I did on one game or another. I mean, Street Fighter 2 was definitely, I think, the epitome of that experience. But.
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. I think, like, for guys like, you know, Alan and yourself and myself, you know, who care about, you know, performance in games, I mean, like, our performance in them, and, you know, we're I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but, you know, I'm a big geek, and, you know, we're really cheap, so we don't want to spend a lot of money either, and so we value kind of this frugality. I agree, that's definitely true. I guess I've also seen, you know, a lot of other people, they will just, you know, just kind of be indiscriminate about it, and I think the difference is that I guess they don't care about, you know, really their performance in the game. They just want to see the game experience, and I guess that's what the quarter crunching thing caters to.
Well,
right.
The way I'm looking at it here is that basically I agree with everything that you're saying, Vlad, about the emotional response and how it increases the tension of the game, and not having that tension, it effectively eliminates a lot of the interest in the game. But at the same time, my contention to that is that the question is really whether or not the game is valuable to even return to at all. And this is something you touched on in the article a little bit too. Like, there are certain people who have that nostalgia response and they want to go back and play it. But I've noticed so often with video games, at least, where because it's an industry that moves forward so much, it's not like I'm nostalgic to go play another board game that I played 20 years ago and I continue to play similar board games now, right?
Right.
Technology moves and the games are so different these days that going back 20 years, honestly, even if I had to pump in quarters, if I went to an arcade and they had a Gauntlet machine, I wouldn't be putting the $5 in. I would maybe play one or two and realize, oh, you know what? This game really doesn't hold its own anymore. It's pretty boring now. And so my question to you is, like, I understand what you're suggesting in the article, but are you actually suggesting they move to this model for retro games, or perhaps for even future independent Xbox Live games?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in this case, with Gauntlet specifically, they missed an opportunity to optimize the experience. And maybe the experience itself was never all that compelling, but I think that it could have been done better. That was the main point. But for future games, you know, I think one reader suggested this in response to my post. Maybe there's an option where you can go into quarter play mode, and at some point, maybe if you're a really good player, you put in 80% of the value of the game if you had purchased it outright, and they said, okay, well, we're going to recognize your achievement. You did really well here, and you've unlocked the full game, and now you're in unlimited play mode. Or if you're really bad at it, maybe you pay a maximum of 110 or 120% of the of what you would have paid if you had bought it outright. That might be a way to bring some of that risk back and some of the excitement back that I think is missing from any retro title on the arcade.
Yeah. I argue that it would never fly having a variable pay rate for the game, but to just say that, okay, if you play it in quarter play mode enough, like to 120% or 200% or whatever, and I have a feeling it would be a lot more than 120% just economically, then you can unlock the whole game. And that's something that I considered before hitting that new article too. Like that sort of makes sense. Give them the option. If they don't use it, then they've received a value. And if they do use it, then they realize that, hey, this is a game I like, and okay, I might have paid more for it, but you know, obviously it's a value to me to have this game.
Well, that's the big question. Would it ever fly? And I think it's all in the way it's positioned. For instance, you wouldn't say, okay, well, you're going to play 120% or 150% of all your games now. You'd say, here's the base price, and if you play really well, you earn a discount on it. So the base price might be set at 120% or 150%, but once you say that's the base, people say that's 100%, and I've got an option to pay 80% if I do really well. So I'm going to give that a shot.
Well, yeah, but once you do it based on skill level, then, you know, you're basically discriminating.
Well, I mean, you'd really have to just say that, I mean, if you're going to charge per play, you just charge per play, and if you spend as much as the game cost outright, then you just have it, right?
Well,
right.
I mean, they could set that it's a certain number of plays equals the whole amount, whereas you could buy the game outright from the beginning. But anyway, we're kind of getting into semantics here.
My
argument is certainly you could never base it off skill level, because then they're going to say you're discriminating against young people with less experience, or handicapped people who can't use the controller with both hands. Like, there's all sorts of issues where that would never actually fly, but I totally understand where you're getting at, and it'd be great, but not going to happen. I don't know. I've got a lot of feelings about this. Like, this is honestly the reason I wanted to talk to you, is because I'd never considered this, and it's something that I really should have considered. It's so obvious, the concept, but never hit my brain. And so I was happy to read this. So stay tuned to this. I want to talk to you for just another minute before we end the show. We're going to go to break, and we'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name's Ara.
I'm Alon.
And we've got Andrew back there, and we also have a guest, Vlad, from joystick.com. How's it going, Vlad?
Going well.
All right. Before we move on, as always, got to mention uat.edu. If you want to get into the industry, like I went to school there, you can go to uat.edu. That's the University of Advancing Technology, to learn more about their programs. Now, Vlad, one thing I wanted to move forward with the same discussion is other possible solutions, because you got a lot of flack from your readership about, you know, trying to fleece gamers, and you argued that we're really not trying to fleece, and we discussed that a second ago. But Ara has his own ideas as a game designer working in the industry now. I'm curious, what sort of solutions do you see as plausible and something that could actually be implemented without actually requiring additional payment from people? Are there other game design elements that might be entered into future games rather than just reproduction of retro games?
Yeah, I think fundamentally the idea of paying $50 for a game is a model that should be reexamined. It was a model that worked well in the days when you went to a store and you picked up a disc or a cartridge and you brought it home and then you played it. But now that we've got all this flexibility that these connected consoles bring to us, I mean, we should really look at different ways to price it. I mean, look at the movies. I think part of the reason that movies are such a mass phenomenon is because you can go and enjoy a movie for basically $5 an hour per person, $10, I mean, at least in New York City. So I think that's what games need to get down to. And you know, we've all seen the reports that basically nobody finishes the games they buy. So there's a lot of paying for content that people never even access. The base price of a game, in my mind, should be $10. And it should provide you with roughly 2 hours of play.
Well, I've always argued that video games offer a much greater value than a movie, because most people do spend more than 10 hours playing a game.
Yeah, they do. I agree. Oblivion, for instance, 80 hours for, you know, $50-$60. But the problem is most people just look at that kind of the absolute payout that they have to make and say, whoa, that's way too much. For games to be accessible and to be a mass phenomenon, which is really what I'd love to see, I think they have to experiment with payment models.
You know what's really funny, actually? I'm not sure if you've seen this or not, Vlad, but I might have even mentioned this on the show a couple times ago. You know, there was this lecture that Phil Harrison gave at DICE a couple years ago, you know, where he was like, how can we keep game prices at $45 or $50 or whatever? And it really seems like, you know, at least particularly Sony, they really, really want to maintain this, you know, 50-level mark for these games.
I don't believe that for a second.
They want it. They don't like this discount stuff. They want to keep people being...
Well, they want to keep it up. Well,
yes,
they're already pricing more than that.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing. They're not going toward, like, DVD-style prices. They're going toward basically as high as they can get them, really.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's just an artifact of a couple of years ago when you had a distribution channel that had to be fed and you've got to keep your retailers fat and happy, and that's just kind of a sweet spot for them.
Right, but is that really different now? I mean, we have some of these online games, but is that really, like, the major channel here?
Well, for now, it still is. I mean, for now, we're in a transition period between the old model and I think something that'll be much more flexible and much, hopefully, much friendlier to both the software creators, the developers, and to the consumers. I mean, the elimination of the physical channel would be great because that's just pure middleman, and all it does is take a little bit of the money away from the gamers and a little bit away from the developers, and who really gains from that?
Can we all in unison agree that that retail channel is not going to disappear for at least a good 20 or 30 years?
2030 is stretching it. I don't know.
I don't know if it's going away for a while.
America was built on capitalism and built on middleman. Like, it is not going away for a really long time.
No, I agree with that.
There certainly, I think we're going to coexist much more so, and Sony's trying to do this. I guess Tekken 5 is their first example of a fully, a more full game that is downloadable for a price without having a physical media. They're trying to test this concept out on their PlayStation 3, but it's not actually going to happen. I mean, a lot of people are playing games. They don't have an internet connection or aren't paying for an internet connection or whatever the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think a number of things have to fall into place. I mean, the internet, the broadband availability needs to become much more ubiquitous. I mean, in my mind, the government isn't doing enough in this country to make that basically another utility. It should be a basic thing that's hooked up in every home in the same way that electricity and water are. And until the government gets serious about that, we're not going to reach this sort of digital distribution nirvana. I mean, another thing that has to happen is publishers themselves have to make some really tough decisions about, it's really difficult to move away from your retail partners. At what point do you do that? You certainly got to support them right now because they're still the power players. But as the retail channel starts to do more and more used games, I mean, they're essentially, you know, really just cutting the publishers and developers out of the picture. It's become pretty antagonistic, I think. And things like Valve with their Steam service, they offer hope, but Valve is going to need to spin that out and make it independent before it can really take off.
Yeah, and we've seen the vulnerability just recently with a situation or a system like that where Steam went down and people essentially couldn't play their games or couldn't buy new games because of the blizzard in Seattle. So, I mean, that's just sort of throwing it in our face that there are other difficulties or other hurdles that we have to overcome before this becomes a reality. And there are very obvious solutions to that with newer technologies and hardware solutions and all that. But
right. I mean, even Gmail is crashing these days. I mean, and people lose their mail on that. So, of course, the always-on online world where you're storing all of your content or all of your things of value on somebody else's server is pretty risky, and we need to reach much higher uptimes and levels of trust before it can really take off. But I don't know. I think it's closer than 20 years.
I think that the main problem is really that, you know, the industry has gotten consumers to get used to paying $40, $50 a game, and consumers have said, yes, we will pay $40, $50 a game. And so, you know, until we start, like, really buying a lot less games at that price point and buying a lot more games at the $15, $10 price point, I think it's going to stay the way it is.
And, by the way, even with digital distribution, we're still going to be paying $50 a game because we still will.
Well, the question is, who is paying $50 a game? I think right now you've got a pretty limited core of, you know, core gamers who are paying that set price point. But I think there are millions upon millions of people who would be willing to game if we could just provide them with a product that met their price requirements or their requirements for enjoyment and time investment and usability and so on. I think there are a number of things. It's not just price, but games have to be easier to play. They need to be much more accessible. They need to provide immediate fun, et cetera.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other 5 hours of discussion.
We can talk about ideals, but tell that to EA, who just sold you know, Madden 2007 through the roof in the last few months.
Yeah. Well, is that through the roof? I mean, could they have sold it? And how many people actually watched the Super Bowl compared to how many people bought Madden 2006, 2007? I mean, it's a pretty small number. It seems like EA is actually leaving a lot of money on the table by not making a product that's accessible to everyone who enjoys watching the Super Bowl.
Okay, so let me ask you this, Vlad. Do you think the more important issue is price or just accessibility of the software itself?
I mean, I think price is the big one, because as soon as you start to push the price point down to, say, $10, or as soon as consoles become subsidized, I mean, a Comcast right now will give you a box that they put on top of your TV. It includes a hard drive, it includes a little computer and chip and all that sort of thing. I mean, what if at some point in the future someone's putting consoles in everyone's living room and, you know, they're subsidizing it because you're going to buy a number of games and movies and so on in a recurring stream throughout the rest of your, you know, enjoyment of that box.
Yeah. So why don't we see, you know, the companies then, you know, why don't we see all the game prices dropping? You know, how come EA buys out, you know, Take-Two or whatever, and Take-Two's $20 game, which sells like crazy, you know, they push off the shelves because of the competition, and they keep up Madden's price up into the high range. Why are they doing that?
I think that's a great counterexample. I mean, I think that's EA protecting their standard business model, because that's what makes them money. That's what, you know, allows them to increase their share price, et cetera, returns to shareholders. But I think that the average price of games has actually fallen thanks to the Internet. And that's in the sale of games sold on Readle and on MSN games and on Yahoo games and on AOL games. People are buying tons of games at much lower price points, about $20 on average.
You can also consider inflation to say that the prices have gone down, right? I was paying $40 a game back in '85. Anyway, Vlad, I don't know if you can hear the music from the phone, but we've got music queuing us out. All right, thank you very much for joining us. I'm sorry I had to cut you short there. Is there anything you want to say before you go?
No, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for having me on the show, and glad you're reading Joystick.
It was a blast, Vlad.
Thank you very much. Everybody should visit joystick.com, joystiq.com. Join us next week for, you know, more Chatterbox Video Game Radio.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your bass belong to us.